The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I want to continue exploring this idea around how we get caught or struggle around a sense of self or identification, and explore some of the teachings, the Buddhist teachings on this, the ways that we struggle, the ways that we suffer around a sense of self. So really exploring how is it that we create, how is it that we get caught by identification, how we get caught by ownership. The Buddha talked about eye-making and mind-making, you know, that is a place where we struggle. So the whole of the Buddhist teachings are really, the emphasis is around where and how do we suffer, and what are the ways that we can understand our experience, and how that very struggle that we experience is not inherent in what's happening in the world, but is part of the process of unfolding conditions in our own mind. Now, this is sometimes this is a teaching that's hard to understand, but it's actually really good news in a way, that whenever we experience struggle, dissatisfaction, unhappiness, what is called, you know, the called suffering, dukkha, the Pali term dukkha, it is not inherent in what's happening in the world. There is going to be conditions in the world that lead to unpleasantness in our experience. And yet that unpleasantness doesn't inherently mean that we have to fight or resist or suffer, feel struggle or stress. And this is actually really good news. We typically think, so many times people have a sense of, somebody's saying something or doing something, and we have the idea, that person is making me mad, that person is making me miserable, that person is making me angry. If they would stop doing that, then I wouldn't be angry. You know, that's a kind of common experience, that we want to try to control what other people are doing, want to control the situations of the world so that we don't feel these challenging or difficult experiences. You know, we don't really like to be angry. We don't like to be frustrated or we don't like that experience, and so we feel like we want to control the world so that we don't have to feel those things. And the Buddha's kind of recognized it's not about controlling the world, it's about understanding how that reactivity happens, that those emotions are created right inside of us. This is really good news, you know. If it were the case that somebody could do or say something that made me angry, there would be no hope for ease of mind. So the exploration becomes, what is happening in this mind and body that is contributing to my sense of unhappiness, my sense of stress, my sense of dissatisfaction, my sense of struggle? What's happening? What's happening in this mind and body? And one of the areas the Buddha explored around this is this sense of self. And he actually pointed to this, it's kind of a key misunderstanding in a way, that pretty much we all have as human beings. I mean, it seems to be something about, there seems to be something about the way this organism is put together that, as a very human thing, it's not like certain cultures have a sense of self and other cultures don't. I mean, it's embedded in just the kind of processes of mind and body that this sense of I am happens. And partly because it is so pervasive, humanly pervasive, we don't question it. We don't question that, well, the sense of I am, which we, you know, we just think about it, you know, it's like, it's such an intuitive feeling that I am, that I exist. And that I-making is kind of a misunderstanding of what's unfolding in the mind and body. We take this process of mind and body and kind of congeal, solidify, interpret that process as being a thing, as being an entity, as being something solid or fixed. And while the the teachings don't deny that there's, I mean, it's an interesting teaching. You know, I think I said the last time I talked about this a couple weeks ago, the Buddha actually pointed. He said, "There is a self, is a mistaken understanding." And then he also said, "There is no self, is a mistaken understanding." So, I mean, those two things. It's like what? if there is a self as a mistaken understanding, then obviously there is no self. But the Buddha said, "No, that's also a mistaken understanding. Any sense of creation of a reality around the sense of self." So the Buddha pointed to process. What we experience in our lives, the process of the unfolding of our mind and body, it is a process that kind of unfolds in this mind and body. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to get confused that my memories, you know, the memories that arise here, the thoughts of when I was a 5-year-old and when I went to high school. I mean, those thoughts are happening here. That experience was kind of the flow of this mind and body process through these 55 years of life. And it's not like that process is going to get mixed up with a process that's happening in your mind and body, in the mind and body there. So there's something happening. There is a flow. There is a stream of something happening. And yet what we typically identify or take to be I or me is a misunderstanding. We congeal, we solidify what is a process into something solid or stable. And so what I'd like to explore today is a teaching that the Buddha offered around various ways that we congeal, various aspects of this mind and body process that we tend to attribute this sense of self to or identify around. So this is kind of a technical teaching in some ways. I'm going to try to make it accessible. And just the very name of the teaching sounds really technical. This is the teaching on the five aggregates. An aggregate itself sounds like, you know, technical term. And that word itself, we don't use that word very much in English. But the word that it's translating from Pali, khanda, was actually a pretty common term in the time of the Buddha. So in the time of the Buddha, it wasn't a technical term. It was a very familiar term, and it seemed to have been used like, you know, you'd carry a khanda of sticks around. You know, it's like a bunch, a collection, a heap, a pile, something like that. So that is what that term, khanda, meant. So it was used in everyday language. It's a heap or a collection or a group or a bunch or something like that. So just a very, you know, ordinary word. The term aggregate in our language, you know, it's actually a really good translation of the term in some ways, because aggregate's has two meanings to it, two sides to it. I mean, like in a geology, aggregate rock, so that's using it as a noun, aggregate as a noun, is a kind of rock that is a rock made of other rocks, right? It's kind of like this rock that's been glued together by other rocks. That's what aggregate rock is. So it's kind of a heap of rocks stuck together, something like that. So that's one definition of aggregate. And another definition of aggregate is as a verb, to aggregate, to collect, to join together. And both sides of that word are, the Buddha pointed to both the process side, the collecting together, the drawing together of a bundle or a heap, and the heap itself as parts of this exploration of these aspects or areas of our experience. So the five aggregates are various aspects of our human life. He divides the mind and body experience into five heaps, five sets of stuff. And I'll just name them right now and then describe them a little bit each. So there's the body as one heap of stuff. There's the, and then the other four are mental, both mental experience and the processes of mind. So there's feeling, whether something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There's perception, the way that we recognize experience. There's it's called mental formations, which is kind of all of the parts of our mind that decide and choose and respond to the world. And then there's consciousness, or how we meet the world or know the world. So the Buddha kind of divided up. Actually, it's possible. There are some scholars that say that this teaching on the aggregates was around already, that this wasn't, that this division, let's say, this division of experience was kind of in the time of the Buddha, how people divided up the mind and body. In the West here, we might divide things up a little differently. For instance, we might distinguish mind stuff and heart stuff. We tend to have that kind of sense of heart stuff being the emotional realm and mind stuff being the intellectual realm. The Buddha didn't divide it up that way. He just divided it up a different way. And so, you know, there's different ways that we could think of dividing up the pie of experience that happens in the mind and body. And it's not saying that one is the right way to divide it up, or, you know, a better way to divide it up. It's just that the Buddha, in his own understanding, saw these processes as ways that we kind of get stuck. And so he highlighted them from that perspective. And the this exploration of these five processes or experiences. Basically, any experience that's happening can be understood completely through various of these parts coming together. So just for right now, so I've named them all, right? Body, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Right now, let's just take the experience of hearing. That's happening right now. There's the body, where there's the ear, and there's the eardrum. This is body. And there is the sound waves. Right now, the sound of my voice is probably the predominant sound wave that's striking the eardrum. All of this is what's called form. You know, that first aggregate is usually called rupa, which is form. And both the sound waves and the body that receives those sound waves are form. So that's, in terms of the hearing, that's the body aspect of the process. There's the movement, right? It's a process that creates this. There's the movement of the air that creates the vibration. There's the movement of the eardrum that creates the resonance that allows the nerve impulses to be sent to the brain to create hearing. So that's body or form. That's the form aspect of that experience. And then consciousness is the kind of the next piece that weaves together the experience, the consciousness of hearing. But there's, you know, just that simple bare knowing of hearing. And then there is, a pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. This is the feeling aspect. Pleasant or unpleasant or neutral aspect of the, in this case, just the vibration itself. You know, it's not, I'll talk in a minute about the content. I mean, the content of what is being heard may have a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality to it. But right now, just in terms of the sound itself, you know, like when music plays, you know, there's just the experience of whether that's, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Maybe the tone of my voice, the quality of my voice may have some a pleasant or unpleasant experience for you. So just that aspect of it. So there's that part of the experience. And then there is the perception. This is where things start to get a little more interesting. So there's, first of all, the perception that hearing is happening, but then there is the taking in of the words and knowing what I'm saying. All of that's a process. I mean, you don't have to do it, right? You don't even have to think about understanding what I'm saying. It just happens. So that's a process in the mind, that process of perceiving and recognizing. Just the words that I'm using, you've heard these words before, you understand their meaning. This whole process of the mind kind of reaching back into memory and understanding what the words are happens automatically. I mean, thank goodness we don't have to do this. Well, thank goodness that doesn't have to be an I in there deciding, and what does that word mean, and what does that word mean? So this process of perception takes in the experience and kind of goes back to memory, looks at what that is. Does it recognize that? And then recognizes it, creates this, the concepts around it. So all the words that I'm saying are understood, and there's concept forming around those words. So that's perception. We could look at perception as kind of being just the creation of idea, concept around experience. And again, this is an automatic process that happens. Then there are mental formations, this next piece of it. And this is more an active experience, where there's a little bit more engagement in a way. Perception is kind of more a simple act of recognition. Some experience happens and the mind kind of does a, you know, could think about it as a pattern matching thing. You know, it's like, that's happened. Oh, let's go find something that was similar to that, call that up, and put that label on it. The mental formation side is a little more active in terms of bringing in other ideas, other explorations. So thoughts you may be having about what I'm saying, ideas that it's pulling, kind of the creation or formation of emotional states. There may be some discomfort, some confusion, some interest. All of that is in this area of mental formations. So mental formations how do those perceptions land? What does the mind do with those perceptions? Thinks about them, responds to them, reacts to them. So this aspect of mental formation has a kind of, one of the key areas or aspects of mental formation is that it has what's called a volitional component to it. It kind of is the active or agency piece of the mind, the part of the mind that chooses and decides and explores and thinks. So it's kind of got an active piece to it. I mean, the perception is active too, but it's more kind of automatic in a way. So the volitional formations, the mental formations, has a sense of creative. It's got that creative aspect to it. It's creating things in our minds and bodies. So those are, like, just for the experience of hearing. The Buddha said, okay, that's all that's happening. You know, name some aspect of your experience that's happening outside of that. You know, even simply the awareness of hearing. You know, you might recognize, oh, there's hearing happening. That's mindfulness, that's awareness, that's a mental formation. And so that, you know, everything in our experience, everything we can point to in our experience is in one of these five heaps. In terms of how we cling to these or get confused about these, where the Buddha pointed to, you know, it's around these five areas, body, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, that we kind of get, it's like sticky glue or something. We kind of begin to congeal and identify a sense of I or me or mine around these five areas. And he had five analogies to help us to kind of get a sense of how each of these areas confuses us into having that sense of solidity, because the sense of self does have that kind of quality of solidity to it. So I think the way I'd like to explore these pieces is to explore those analogies. You know, the Buddha was actually really brilliant with analogies, and there's a lot to these analogies that I think can help us to understand how we get stuck. So,
I think you left out consciousness.
Now that was at the beginning. I said once with hearing, you know, I said the ear, you know, there was the ear, and then there was a simple knowing of hearing. That was consciousness. Yeah, so that was the first one I started with after the body. So these five analogies. The Buddha said, the body is like a lump of foam. And he said that, you know, think about, apparently on the Ganges River, you know, there's a lot of organic matter, you know, in the river, and you know, it just gets churned up with all the activity of the river, and it creates these lumps of foam that hang out on the river. And you can see this over at Santa Cruz too, at the beach. You know, sometimes at particular times of the year, you know, there's a lot of these lumps of foam hanging around. And from a distance, they, you know, look kind of solid. You know, it looks like, you know, there's that big lump of stuff. And the Buddha would say, you know, the Buddha said, you know, look at that lump of foam. You know, from a distance, it looks like it's a thing. But you know, a person with good eyesight, a person who understands the way that works, understands that that is just simply a lump of foam. And, you know, if you go to try to pick up that lump of foam, it's like it all just disintegrates in your hands. It's put together by the process of the churning. It's put together by, you know, the just a gathering of the organic matter with the churning of the water. It's a process that comes into being, and then it has a life that hangs out for a while. So kind of similarly, you know, our bodies are a process put together by food. It's kind of amazing to think about that, but, you know, we eat our food, and it gets, you know, digested. It's an amazing process. It gets digested, and like the food that we eat actually builds our cells and, you know, creates the blood and stuff running through our bodies. And, you know, it's like this body is created from food. And it was originally, you know, it's originally created from the food that created the sperm and the egg and our parents and that joining together. I mean, it's like it's a process. So the kind of the analogy points to how it seems so solid. You know, it looks so solid, and yet it's simply a process that's come together. Now, how do we identify with the body? You know, what is it that we kind of congeal around? You know, where we take it to be me or mine. I think a lot, Bhikkhu Anālayo actually for each of these areas pointed to kind of a key place that we tend to get stuck. He said, we think about the body as being where I am. So that sense of I, you know, we are living in this body. Or the body is mine. Now, how does that create suffering? How does that create a problem to think of the body as mine or as I am in the body? One of the keys the Buddha pointed to, there's a couple key pieces around each of these aggregates that the Buddha pointed to. One is that when we think of something as being I or mine, we attribute a sense of control to it, or that this I can control this thing. So this body is mine, and the way the Buddha put it, he said, when we think of this body being mine, or I am in the body, it's like there's a subtle or not so subtle sense that I should be able to control this body. You know, and we can, to some extent, control the body. I mean, I can choose to raise my hand and pick up the glass of water. You know, so there's some sense of agency or control around the body. And that sense of agency or control around the body gets extrapolated to the sense of I should be able to control the body completely. You know, the Buddha says, we have this sense when we have that sense of self around body. May my body be thus. May my body not be thus. You know, it's like, can we do that? He said, if there were actually a self that owned the body or controlled the body, that would be possible. and it's not possible. And he actually points to the impossibility of saying, may my body be thus, may my not body not be thus, as being a pointer to this fallacy of self around the body, this misinterpretation of self around the body. So, you know, examples around this, you know, yesterday I was putting on my shoes, and the shoes were right at a little edge, a corner, and they're flip-flops, so I was, you know, going to put my foot into the flip-flop, and they were right at a corner, and as I moved my foot, I misdirected a little bit and jammed my foot into the corner of the wall. It's like pain, right? And if body were self, you know, may my body not be thus. You know, I had no choice. I mean, this mind-body process had no choice but to experience the wash of pain that went through the body when that happened. So that misattribution of there being a sense of self begins to create a struggle or a suffering when we run up against that barrier, that boundary of places where we don't have control. We sometimes think it's a mistake, you know, like I easily could have gone down one of two routes, and I know I've seen this in my mind in the past. It's like, I was so stupid, why didn't I, like, you know, put my shoes someplace else, or blaming somebody else. I mean, I've seen my mind do this too. How can I blame somebody else for, like, you know, they shouldn't have put that wall there? I've seen the mind do that. It's amusing. You know, so you know, the mind will go to these blamings when it runs up against this sense of out of control. It will either attribute a problem, like, I did something wrong, I was a fool, or somebody else did something wrong, other. So self and other. So that running up against that lack of control is one of the key areas that we suffer in all of these areas, in all of the areas of the aggregates. I'll try to get to all of them here today. So that lack of control, we take it personally. We feel like I should have been able to do something different. You know, we get cancer. You know, what did I do wrong? You know, what food did I eat? What, you know, did I eat too many pesticides? Or, you know, we feel like we should have been able to control the body, and that we are at fault for not being able to control the body. This is where the suffering comes in. And the Buddha points out, it's out of control. It's not actually within the control of a self. It is a process unfolding. Like that lump of foam, it will disintegrate in its own time. It will come together in its own time. Another good analogy for the body, I think, is a whirlpool in water. You know, there's a in a river, you know, sometimes the formation of various rocks and whatnot will create a whirlpool. You've all seen this, right? And, you know, the whirlpool has some sense of, it's like it's often in that spot, you know, at least for a period of, you know, minutes or hours, you can sit there and watch the whirlpool. You know, that something's coherent about the conditions that allow that creation of that whirlpool. And stuff gets caught up in that whirlpool. You know, sticks or leaves, it kind of gets stuck in there. But what is that whirlpool? You know, it's a set of conditions. There's no thing. I mean, sometimes those sticks or leaves will kind of stay stuck in there for a little while, but, you know, there's no thing in there that you can point to and say, that's the whirlpool. In fact, those sticks and leaves you wouldn't say are the whirlpool. You would say those things are caught in the whirlpool. But the whirlpool itself is just a set of conditions made up of the river, and it's continually changing. You know, there's not even a a bit of water that's the same in that whirlpool moment to moment. Very similar to the body. So that's a little about that analogy of body. Body is like a lump of foam. Feeling is an airy bubble. I was up at a retreat center in Washington, and we had a lot of rain in Washington State, so we had some rainy days, and there were some ponds there. And watching the water, the rain fall into the water, there were little bubbles that would appear with the drops. And those bubbles, you know, the conditions came together for that bubble to appear. It's like somehow the drop of the rain into the water creates a little burst of air or something, you know. The bubble hangs out on the surface. And those bubbles have a coherency for a while, again. You know, they linger, they float, they, you know, and then suddenly in a split second, it's gone. So again, you know, there's a little bit of a lingering quality to that bubble. And likewise, I think this is part of what the Buddha is pointing to around this analogy. There can be a lingering quality to feeling. When we experience something as pleasant or unpleasant, like that stubbing of my toe, it's like that unpleasant experience lingered for a while. You know, the strong unpleasantness. And then it, you know, kind of began to fade. So I think that analogy is pointing to the way feelings can seem to linger. And we get caught in feeling. I think a lot around feeling, we get caught partly because feeling here, again, just that sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. The word feeling we often take to be emotion, but the Buddha was actually pointing to this more simple process of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. We take it personally when things are unpleasant or pleasant, and again have that sense of control. That sense of, I should be able to control whether the experience is pleasant. I should be able to control whether the experience is unpleasant. Pleasant and unpleasant come about through causes and conditions. The conditions of, you know, where I put my shoes and how I was moving my foot led to that unpleasant experience. And so the you know, again, we have this sense of, if I cannot control whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, we suffer around that. We suffer when it feels like I'm at fault when experience is unpleasant. I'm at fault when I can't fix the unpleasant. I'm at fault when pleasant goes away. We feel, so there's that identification around the feeling where we take it personally. The next one is perception. I described perception before being like that recognition process, that, you know, identifying something from memory, basically. Perception's very connected to memory. We, you know, from the time of being a baby, the perceptual process is at work. Seeing things, recognizing things, knowing this experience has happened again and again and again, and beginning to kind of recognize what's happening. So that process at work, very helpful process. You know, walking down the street and seeing tree and seeing sidewalk and seeing car. It's a process that happens so automatically. We're often not aware of it as a process. We just take what we are seeing to be reality, and really helpful process to know the difference between a tree and a car, you know, to you know, recognize car and, you know, knowing that stepping out in front of that car is going to be dangerous to this being. So very helpful process. What happens around perception, where we get confused, where the identification happens, is that we misconstrue what we are perceiving as being what's really there. you know, what's happening in our experience is that the mind takes in sight and sound and all of the senses, you know, it takes that in and it recognizes what is there. And then it the mind tends to get kind of confused. So, you know, like seeing that chair, you know, there's something out there that's chair. That I certainly believe there's a chair there. But what I am experiencing of that is the sight of the chair and the recognition, the knowledge of having seen chairs like that before. And the actual experience of chair is something in the mind. That's hard to see. It's kind of hard to see. You might have to just take that on faith at first. But everything that we take in, all of our experience, what we actually experience, I mean, just like the contact here, my hands touching this hard surface, that experience is known through the mind, the processes of mind. If there were not consciousness, if there were not perception happening, that experience would not be known. And so everything that we experience is simply a reflection of what's out there. What we are actually experiencing is a reflection, not the reality. It's very much like what Plato talked about in the allegory of Plato's cave. Are you familiar with that? You know, it's like the confusion of the reflection or the shadows for what's actually there. So this is our world. It's not a problem that we are experiencing a reflection. That's how we experience the world. The confusion happens when we take that reflection to be what's actually there. So the Buddha used the analogy of perception as being like a mirage. And this is actually a really great analogy. The more I looked into, you know, what actually is a mirage? I mean, we use mirage in a kind of a, you know, colloquial way or familiar way to mean seeing something that's not there. But the reality of what a mirage is that it is, you know, like it, the classic mirage in the desert of seeing a lake. I read about this. It's actually when we see a lake, what we see is like this lake, shimmering lake on the desert. What we are seeing is because of the refraction of the air, the you know, the water vapor or lack thereof in the air, what we are seeing is a reflection of the sky on the ground. So it looks like a blue lake to see that. So it is a reflection of reality being misconstrued as something else, something that it is not. That's the analogy the Buddha used for perception. And that's where we get caught. We take something to be the reality, and, you know, just think about how we do this with people. You know, all of our ideas about people, you know, we bring, so there's the, you know, the perception of somebody comes along with all of our previous interactions with them, which, you know, has all kinds of ideas about who they are and what they do and what they don't do. And so we see people through that lens, that constructed lens. We see ourselves through a constructed lens. Rather than, these lenses tend to limit us. So I don't have a lot more time, so I want to move on. Which ones have I done? Let's see, I've done body, feeling, perception, mental formations. Let's see if I can do these both quickly. Mental formations is, you know, all of that, the terrain of mental experience So this includes all of our emotions, our thought processes, states of mind too, like boredom or confusion or calm or ease or peace or concentration. All of those are in this terrain. This is huge. This is a huge lump of stuff. This is probably the biggest lump of stuff. You know, just think about, in particular, an area of pattern or habit, you know, a pattern or habit in your mind where you tend to get caught, you know, a habit or pattern of confusion or for myself, miserable. I was miserable so much of my life. It was like this pattern of being miserable had lots of different threads to it. It had threads around feeling like I was a bad person or, you know, a failure. It had threads of feeling, you know, sad about myself. It had feelings of being self-righteous about why are people doing these things to me, you know. All of these pieces. So the mental formations are like a swirl of lots of threads. It's kind of like, almost like all these different threads of coming together to make a ball of yarn or something. It feels so solid. The Buddha's analogy for mental formations is a banana tree. It's like a banana tree. And a banana tree, for those of you who've not experienced banana trees, I was in the Peace Corps in the South Pacific, so I did get to experience banana trees. And they're pretty solid, you know, their trunks can be pretty big, maybe about 6 inches across. They're, you know, pretty solid looking things. When you want to cut them down, you need to take a hatchet to it. It's like, it feels pretty solid. But what a banana tree actually is it's got all these leaves, you know, they're kind of these tall leaves, and the leaves have a long stalk on the bottom. And the trunk of the banana tree is like all those stalks just coming together to weave this solid kind of thing. And so if you chop that banana tree down and then try to find the core of the banana tree, start pulling leaves off, pull this leaf off, pull that leaf off, pull that leaf off, what you end up is a pile of leaves and there's nothing there. There's nothing solid in the middle of that banana tree. It is, the solidity is created by the layering of all of those parts. And very similarly, the solidity of our patterns is created by all the threads that come together. And this is a big area of identification, a big area of suffering. I am a miserable person. Again, this kind of weaves together with that misperception in a way, and the kind of, you know, I am a miserable person. You know, there's a perception there as well, as, you know, the whole mistaken sense of the solidity of that through the many layers of experience that come together there. When when this mind and body had that view, that concept or that identification of I am a miserable person, experience was filtered through that lens. I am a miserable person. And pretty much, because it was self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's like seeing things through that lens, I'm a miserable person. The mind tends to pull out of experience things that confirm that belief and ignores things that don't confirm that belief. And so, you know, this, before I began practicing, I remember having the experience of recognizing, you know, that there were times that I was happy, times when things were going well, and the mind, in seeing that, saw that through the lens of well, I'm happy now, but really what I know is that I'm miserable. You know, it couldn't take in the truth of happy now. It had that solidity around I'm miserable. So much of our suffering happens in this terrain. So much of our suffering. Okay, I'm not going to get to talk about the last one. So, next week, I'll continue with consciousness. So, thank you.